I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Well, one thing seems clear today. John McCain is a winner. Radio's Rush Limbaugh, not so much. McCain has 500 new delegates despite a heated radio campaign against him in the run-up to Tuesday's primary. Mitt Romney gained 176 delegates, Mike Huckabee 147. The Democrats are still counting. So far, Hillary Clinton's won more delegates than Barack Obama, but he's won more states. But Super Tuesday is becoming a receding signpost on the road to the presidential nomination. Ahead, caucuses and primaries from Hawaii to Washington State, more than 500 delegates at stake just in the next week, and our first guest says also at stake the future of the parties. Gerald Seib writes the Capital Journal column for the Wall Street Journal. His headline today, "When Will the Wounds Heal?" He joins us now. Jerry, welcome.
Thank you.
You write, yesterday's results laid bare and exacerbated the splits in both parties. Let's start as you do with the Democrats. You write that the race between Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama is really highlighting divisions that undermine the party's core identity. Tell us more about that.
Well, what you have are clear divides emerging in voting patterns in lots of states now along racial and gender lines. And, you know, racial and gender unity has been sort of a hallmark of what the Democratic Party likes to think of itself as representing. For example, Georgia yesterday, where more than half of the Democratic electorate was African American, that group went 80% for Barack Obama. Conversely, you had a state, California, where there was a large Hispanic turnout, and two-thirds of it went for Hillary Clinton. You have, in state after state, women voting more heavily for Hillary Clinton than for Barack Obama. And you even have an age split to a certain extent. I mean, she's clearly doing better among older voters, and he's clearly doing better among younger voters. So, you know, none of these things are mortal blows, and maybe they just show natural preferences that emerge in a primary, but they have the potential to become deeper problems if those who don't win feel that they have somehow been cheated out of the right to see their candidate nominated for the Democratic Party in a year in which Democrats actually think they're likely to win.
Well, let me ask you about that, because you just alluded to something I was going to ask you. You know, aren't there other forces at work here? The Hispanic vote for Clinton, it could be because of what's being called a tension between Hispanics and blacks as they compete for a seat at the table. But it also could be that Hillary Clinton has a history with unions in the Hispanic community. Barack Obama simply doesn't yet. I mean, it's not necessarily a schism or politics that the party can't accept.
No, it's not. But here's the potential problem for Democrats is if this remains as close as it is and it goes all the way to the convention, you're going to have a fight over who gets which delegates in Florida and Michigan, two big states where Hillary Clinton won. And, you know, that has the potential to get very tense and very nasty. And you have the potential for wounds that don't heal all that easy. It doesn't mean it's going to work out that way. It's just that you do see patterns now emerging that show the different views of the party about where they should be going in 2008.
I happened to be in Florida when that primary was taking place, and I heard a black woman say, "You mean to tell me we fought so long to get the right to vote, and they're going to take it away?"
That's a pretty hard argument to deal with.
Well, but speaking of the black vote, which, as you have said, is largely for Barack Obama, the female vote largely for Hillary Clinton, doesn't it make sense for people who are able to vote for someone of their gender or color for the very first time to do so? Again, isn't that something that the party can, you know, embrace?
It's natural. On the other hand, you know, it sort of belies the idea that, well, we've transcended gender and racial issues in voting patterns, and they're still there. And again, there's nothing wrong with that, but you have two potential kinds of history-making candidacies here. One, the first black to be nominated by a major party, or the first woman to be nominated by a major party. And those on both sides of that divide have great desire to see their first realized, and there may be some resentment if it's not.
Well, one other thing could be happening for both parties in that McCain could wrap up the nomination and be sitting on the sidelines while Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama slug it out and perhaps, you know, can't refrain from throwing some mud in there as well.
If that's what happens, then you have the opportunity for John McCain to start healing the wounds within his own party, and the possibility that the Democrats spend a lot more time and money, frankly, arguing and fighting with each other rather than getting ready to argue and fight with the Republicans.
Right. Let's take a look at the Republican side, though, because you say there's a much deeper divide there. And I heard an analyst this morning say that conservative talk radio hosts woke up to their worst nightmare. They'd been vilifying John McCain, backing Romney, but they may have created Mike Huckabee. Tell us about the divide in the Republican Party.
You have conservatives who don't like John McCain expressing that dislike. Self-identified, very conservative Republicans are voting consistently in smaller numbers for John McCain than other kind of Republicans are. But you're seeing those conservatives vote their feelings against John McCain in two different ways. Some are going with Mitt Romney, who appeals more to economic conservatives, and some are going with Mike Huckabee, who appeals more to social conservatives. And so you essentially have the three legs of the Republican stool, the national security conservatives sticking with John McCain, the economic conservatives drifting toward Romney, and Mike Huckabee pulling in the social conservatives. And the task of every Republican presidential nominee in the last generation has been to pull those three groups together. That is looking like it's going to be a difficult task for John McCain if he wins the nomination. So there's a real schism, and it goes to the heart of what being a Republican means in 2008.
The percentages are really interesting. Among conservative voters, Mitt Romney wins with Republicans, 36% of the vote, McCain 31, Huckabee 24. That would seem to be a real divide, you know, a John McCain who isn't winning the conservative base, potentially the nominee. I mean, the Republicans have a deeper wound to heal, it would seem.
It appears that way now because it, you know, it goes to the a split within the base that has provided the strength for the Republican Party since Ronald Reagan united the party around a conservative agenda in 1980. It may be, though, that the silver lining in this cloud for Republicans is the ability to begin expanding the Republican coalition beyond that. John McCain obviously has appeal to independents, to moderate Republicans, and to Republicans who may have been tempted to drift someplace else. If you can get beyond this fight, and if you can convince conservatives who don't like John McCain that he's better than any Democratic alternative, the happy possibility is that he can retain that base and expand beyond it.
The language, though, has been so visceral. As you say, McCain has to reunite and claim a conservative base that is now somewhere between suspicious and hostile.
Mm-hmm.
Accent on hostile.
Yeah. Listen to Rush Limbaugh and you get hostile. You know, not just Rush Limbaugh, but, you know, listen to the dialogue Rush Limbaugh has with many of his listeners about John McCain. Or frankly, if you write about some of this, as I do, read the emails you get from some people. I mean, there are conservatives who say, I will never vote for John McCain. Now, maybe that's what they really mean, and maybe it's what they mean in February and won't mean
right.
in November, but that's the dialogue underway right now, and it's not helpful to the Republican cause broadly.
Gerald Seib writes the Capital Journal column for the Wall Street Journal. His article today is entitled, When Will the Wounds Heal? Jerry, thanks for speaking with us.
Happy to be here.
Well, technically, Super Tuesday went pretty well, although in Virginia, some voters showed up only to learn that their primary is next week. Florida voters showed up and discovered theirs was last week. In Georgia, where voters were required to show photo IDs, the wait was as long as 90 minutes. The lines were hours long in New Mexico, where election officials ran out of ballots at a handful of sites. And in Illinois, about 20 voters were given touchscreen styluses instead of ink pens. A ballot judge assured them the pens were filled with invisible ink, and election officials are now tracking down those voters so that they can mark their ballots with a real pen. But overall, and with record turnouts, the vote went pretty well. So where do the candidates go from here? Joining us now, Tad Devine, a Democratic Party strategist not currently aligned with any presidential candidate, but he was senior strategist on the Gore-Lieberman campaign in 2000 and the 2004 Kerry campaign. Tad, welcome as always.
Nice to be with you.
We also welcome Todd Domke, a Republican analyst who writes for the Boston Globe. Todd, welcome back to you as well.
Thank you. Good to be with you.
And Ted, just I want to start with you and, you know, react to some things we just heard from Jerry Seib. He says the Republicans are the most wounded by this process. But Adam Nagorny writes in The New York Times today that your party is, because if McCain does wrap it up, the Republicans go off and heal their wounds. But the Democrats now have months of more divisive debate. Your thoughts?
Well, my thoughts is I agree with Jerry that there are clear divides, but I don't believe that we're divided. I mean, I think African Americans who voted for Barack Obama, if Hillary Clinton wins the process, they'll be happy to support her. And likewise, women who voted for Hillary, I think, will be happy to support Barack
do you really
and
think
Obama.
That, do you really think that's true? Because we were just hearing of Republicans who wouldn't ever vote for John McCain. But then, you know, you talk around the water cooler. Some people say I would never vote for Clinton or vice versa.
Yeah, I don't see that in the polling. I mean, mm-hmm. I see two candidates, you know, they win support, but both of them have enormous favorability and very little unfavorability with these Democratic primary voters. So I think it's going to be easy to put our party together if these two candidates maintain the tone and tenor that they've had in recent days. If the campaign resembles the debate they had in California in the weeks ahead, it will be easy to heal our party. If the campaign resembles the debate they had in South Carolina the week before, then it's going to be a difficult challenge.
Todd, what about your party? Is it good news, bad news that Mike Huckabee is doing so well? What's your estimate there?
Well, it was certainly good news for John McCain that Huckabee did so well, because it really probably put Romney out of business. Romney now is at the end of the road and probably looking for the off-ramp.
Well, you joked today that Romney's wife may be putting a post-it on his wallet that says closed for business. Do you think he can continue to spend his own money?
I don't think he has been since Florida really spending anything significant. I mean, he had his decision weeks ago to go maybe into the bank account for another $35 million and really make a stand on Super Tuesday. He chose not to. I think his campaign realized then, after Florida, certainly, that there was no great future here. The radio talk show hosts, who then start rallying around him and going after McCain, gave them some hope. They went with that hope instead of just ratcheting down the rhetoric. But then they saw on Super Tuesday that it was a super disappointing Tuesday. Let me say this about the Democrats, though. I understand what Ted is saying that when you look at the polls now and recent elections. But I think there's something, as we say, about this Obama phenomenon that is, in fact, phenomenal, and that is the turnout. The turnout among African Americans, so much higher, as we saw in places like South Carolina, so much more among the young, and the way it would hurt the Democratic Party if Hillary were the nominee is that high, unbelievably high turnout among blacks and young, if Obama is the nominee, is just not going to happen. Many will stay at home. So it won't be necessarily reflected now in the polls. Many of them would say yes, Hillary is perfectly acceptable. But I think there would, especially among the young, there would be disillusionment. And I think among the blacks, there would be great disillusionment if Hillary wins this nomination.
But Ted, is it good for the party, as Hillary Clinton says, now that people are so energized?
I think it's very good. I mean, I take Todd's point that, you know, there is tremendous enthusiasm, particularly with young voters and African-American voters around Barack Obama. But I also believe that, you know, his charisma and, you know, Hillary's historic bid are not the only things that are driving this turnout. I think the turnout is driven in large measure by the incredible issues confronting the country, the fact that the country is about to go, or already has gone, into a recession, the fact that we're engaged in a very unpopular war, the fact that people's lives are affected by the lack of health care, and other real issues. I think those things are driving people and are the impulse behind this movement towards change, you know, not just charismatic candidates.
Let me look at the issues real quick. On the Democratic side, exit poll says the top issue was economy, followed by the war in Iraq, health care. On the Republican side, the economy, followed by immigration, the war in Iraq, and terrorism. We're going to talk more about what last night's vote might mean going ahead with Todd Domke, Republican analyst who writes for the Boston Globe, and Tad Devine, a Democratic Party strategist. We'll do that in just 1 minute. I want to hear from both of you. Where do you think each of these candidates now has to really work hard, the states that are coming up very quickly? Back in 1 minute, here and now. It's the day after and the day before. Several primaries coming up, one as soon as tomorrow in Hawaii. We're talking the presidential elections with Tad Devine, a Democratic Party strategist, currently not aligned with any candidate, but he was senior strategist on the Gore-Lieberman campaign in 2000, the 2004 Kerry campaign as well. Also, Todd Domke's with us. He's a Republican analyst who writes for the Boston Globe. And Tad, I want to start with you first. Where do you think each of the candidates, looking ahead, looking out at some of the many states that are having their primaries and caucuses ahead, where does each of them have to focus?
Well, we begin a whole new phase of the process, where instead of playing on this huge stage of a national primary or individual stages in the early states, it's sort of a smaller theater now they play in, one or two states at a time. And, you know, we've got some events this weekend in places like Louisiana and Maine and Washington State coming up next Tuesday in the Mid-Atlantic region in and around Washington, Virginia, and Maryland, and then Wisconsin, which is an important standalone event. But I think the big day will come in early March when Ohio and Texas have primaries on the same day, along with Rhode Island and Vermont. And if one candidate can build some momentum going into that day, can capture both of those big states, you know, that candidate is probably going to emerge as the front runner. But I think this thing will continue probably then all the way until the Pennsylvania primary in late April.
And maybe beyond that on the Democratic side. I mean, some are saying it may not be a floor fight, but it may go to the convention and the question of whether or not Hillary Clinton will demand that the Florida delegates that she won be released by the party who, you know, of course, punished the candidates for or punished the state for moving up the primary.
That's right. And these are very complicated issues. The Florida-Michigan issue right now is enormously complex because we have such a close nominating process. And also the issue of superdelegates who, given our system of proportional representation, in the end, they will provide the margin of victory to whoever the nominee is. Those two issues need to be handled very carefully, particularly in light of the point I think that Todd made earlier, which is that if segments and important constituencies in our party, like African Americans, feel that either the superdelegates or a challenge in Michigan and Florida have somehow disenfranchised their votes, this could lead to enormous problems. So these are politically sensitive. They need to be dealt with. We'll have to wait and see how the campaigns and the party deal with these issues.
And Todd Domke, on the Republican side, let's look a little ahead at your party's road ahead and talk a little bit about the system. For instance, I'm thinking of Texas, where we understand that it's winner take all if you win 50% of the votes, but it's proportional if you win less than 50% of the votes, but you get no delegates if you win less than 20% of the votes. So the system, a lot of Americans are paying more attention to the system on both sides than they ever have. Has the Republican system of largely winner take all been unfair to Mitt Romney, who's been so close with John McCain in so many states but lost the whole state?
Well, in most of those states that McCain won, Romney wasn't close, you know, in the northeastern states. But if you look ahead to Wisconsin and Ohio and Pennsylvania, where independents can vote in the primary, that will favor McCain. But frankly, I just don't think Romney can stay in this race. I think he's trying to think of what's the best thing to do. Is there a gracious exit, or should he stay in just to keep his radio talk show allies happy so that if he runs again next time, they'll be with him? I mean, he's got a lot of figuring out to do, but in terms of future primaries, it doesn't look good for him because he and Huckabee would split the anti-McCain vote.
And what happens with Huckabee? I think it was you who said earlier today that what we're watching is Mike Huckabee running for vice president. Has he already perhaps won it? There are some who feel that when John McCain released some of his delegates to Mike Huckabee in West Virginia, that may have been part of a deal.
Well, I think there's been an understanding between the two camps that they don't want to see Romney as the nominee. And so I think there's been a little cooperation now and then. But I don't think it would go to the point where one would even covertly say to the other, you'll be my running mate if things work out. But, if McCain ends up as president, you know, he might instead turn to Huckabee for a cabinet position or something. I think Governor Crist of Florida is someone that McCain would be looking at. But looking ahead, this Thursday, the Conservative Political Action Conference, which is a gathering of all the conservative activists in the country, McCain will be speaking there. He could begin his comeback with a lot of conservatives there because many of them need Hillary Clinton for their fundraising, and they need a plausible candidate against her. So there's reason for them to be more interested and more supportive of him.
Well, Todd Domke, that's the Republican side. We asked you about the system. Tad Devine, you helped develop the Democratic system of proportional delegation of delegates that we're now working under. You started it about 20 years ago. Is it working? Did it work this time around?
Well, I think it's being tested. And, I mean, the reason that we made those changes in 1988 was that, you know, Jesse Jackson had won a lot of delegates and really felt that he hadn't received delegates in proportion to the votes that he had received and insisted on the changes. And actually, Governor Dukakis, frankly, was very happy with proportional representation. It was a system in place in Massachusetts. The reformers in Massachusetts liked it. We haven't tested it. I think It's working okay thus far. If we have a stalemate and no one can really achieve a nomination, then I think the system will have failed. And, you know, I think the problem is not so much proportional representation as the fact that we've had this enormous front-loading. There's so many states that came to the first day of permissible voting after the pre-window period, as they call it in the rules. So, you know, for me, the problem is not so much proportional representation. It's the combination of enormous front-loading with proportional representation that has led to this situation.
And some would say that that gave states who never really were factors a chance to be factors. But to remind ourselves, the idea was to get away from backroom politics, give more of the voice to the electorate. They delivered the candidate George McGovern, and so the party decided maybe we should have more of the superdelegates involved. And it sounds as if, just very briefly, we're running out of time here, but it sounds as if it may, if it goes down to the wire, it may be back to the superdelegates, the party officials deciding the candidate.
I think it is back to the superdelegates, without a doubt. But the question is, will the superdelegates listen to voters and follow their leads, or will the superdelegates go against the express wishes of voters who participate in primaries and caucuses? I think if they follow the lead of the voters, there'll be no problem. And if they don't, there'll be a lot of problems.
Well, and there is a chance they might follow the lead, and it's evenly split. Tad Devine, Democratic Party strategist, also Todd Domke with us from the Republican side. Gentlemen, thank you both, and we'll do it again.
Good to be with you.
And later in the program, a recession road trip, traveling the country to talk to business people, entrepreneurs. That's after the news, here and now. Go to 7 cities in 7 days and take the pulse of entrepreneurs. Find out how their businesses are faring as talk of a recession looms. Well, that was David Whitford's latest assignment as editor-at-large for Fortune magazine. His trip took him from Medford, Oregon to Portland, Maine, Phoenix, El Paso, Cincinnati, Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and Charleston, South Carolina. And he joins us now to tell us what he found. Welcome, David.
Hi, Robin.
You say you weren't going for a photograph, a snapshot, but rather many, a kaleidoscope of what's happening. But why entrepreneurs?
Well, our interest was in business owners, in people who are dealing with local economic conditions and aren't so much concerned with the big sort of national issues like fuel prices, currency fluctuations, trade deficit with China, and that sort of thing.
First stop, Medford, Oregon, a community that's seen a real estate boom go bust. Timber subsidies for logging on federal lands cut back. We did this story so much so cut back on revenues that they had to close their libraries for a while there. What are they doing to try to replace some of that lost revenue?
I don't think they've come up with a way to replace that revenue. I mean, basically what they're doing right now is cutting budgets. The county commissioners have come up with a budget that doesn't include any of that $23 million that they had received in 2006 and did not receive in 2007. Right. So it's cutback time in Medford.
Okay. Medford, Oregon, where in 2007, 781 people lost their homes in foreclosure. So tough real estate business there.
There's another real estate stat on that. The local real estate association, which includes the local realtors, had 1,500 members a year ago. At year-end this year, they were down to 1,000, and the expectation is that sometime before this year is over, they'll be down to 750.
Okay.
So real estate agents going out of business as the real estate economy collapses.
So there's a trickle-down. Making your way east, you found a vibrant economy in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, unemployment at 2.5%, stable housing market, growing labor force, and you say behind that you found what?
Lots of immigrants. We stopped in at a place called Star Mark Cabinetry. It's one of the largest manufacturers in Sioux Falls. And when I walked onto the shop floor there, I thought I was walking into the United Nations. It turns out that Sioux Falls has gone out of its way, partly with the help of Lutheran Social Services and partly as a matter of social policy, to encourage legal immigration. They're desperate for workers there. Immigrants from these places are dependable and hardworking. And Sioux Falls is prospering as a result.
And legal, we should add.
That's right.
Well, you found some foreboding in Sioux Falls as well. They have a big credit card banking center. Citibank and Wells Fargo have thousands of employees. But, you know, because of the subprime crisis, there's fear that that's going to spill over into the credit card market. In fact, there was just recently an announcement of laying off 100 workers in Iowa by Citibank. But you also found a woman we want to speak to for just a couple minutes. Her name is Stephanie Wallman. She's 24, the mother of two. She used to work at one of those credit card companies. She worked at a call center. That's where you got sent if you want to, let's say, cancel your account. But today she and her husband have another job. I want to bring her up now. Stephanie, are you there?
Yes, I am.
What are you and your husband planning to do there?
Well, right now we manufacture concrete statues, and when we're not doing that, we're installing seamless gutter on houses, or we're running a concession stand somewhere, or renting out big machinery to contractors who need them.
We also understand you've got 66 acres of farmland and some restaurant work?
Yeah, we own 66 acres of farmland, and my parents also own three different restaurants, so we're over there, and you know, last time I was there, I walked in the back door, and they said, good, we're glad you're here. Can you wash dishes for us?
Well, now, this is a very wide economic range. Is part of this to maybe not put all your apples in one basket in case people don't buy those apples? Is it to stave off the effects of a recession?
It's not necessarily to stave off the effects of a recession. It's just we were at the right place at the right time, and we saw an opportunity, so we jumped on it.
So are you worried about some trickle-down effect from the economic stories you're hearing elsewhere, or do you think people are always going to want statues and, you know, heavy equipment?
People are always going to need heavy equipment when they're adding additions onto businesses and churches around here. And people are always going to want concrete statues. Even in the middle of a recession, people, if they want it bad enough, they're going to save up the money to buy it. I just had a lady in here a couple months ago who liked a $1,500 statue, and she's been saving up since just so she can buy it.
Huh. Stephanie Wallman of Sioux Falls, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
You know, David, it's interesting. She's echoing something you found back in Oregon. You met an entrepreneur who does tattoos, and he said the same thing. He said, you know, even when there's no money, people are going to save for what they want, like a tattoo.
Their skin art. He said they won't buy gasoline, and they'll save up for their skin art.
Well, let's move, though, to Phoenix, Arizona, because there was a different story there. You talked with Harjit Sodhi.
That's right.
He can't sell his house. He keeps dropping the price. He says the convenience stores and the Indian restaurants he owns are losing business because?
Because there are fewer Mexicans in Phoenix now than there were even a few weeks ago. State of Arizona has recently passed a draconian anti-immigration law that has greatly reduced the number of presumably illegal Mexicans who were a vital part of the Arizona economy.
Are you hearing this from others besides Harjit Sodhi? You know, because an entrepreneur might have a vested interest in one who he is an immigrant himself, in saying that that's the problem.
Well, I think Harjit's on the front lines. He runs a restaurant, and so he employs a lot of kitchen help. Now, that kind of work has traditionally been done by new Americans and immigrants of all kinds, and he sees that there are fewer of them available now there to work. He also operates several convenience stores and members of his extended family. Convenience stores do a big business selling snack food and soft drinks to working people on break. And what he has found in recent weeks is that his business is down about 20%, and he attributes that to just simply the fact that there are fewer Mexicans in Phoenix now than there were before this law took effect.
Hmm. In El Paso, Texas, you met with a coffee shop owner who told you that things are bad on Wall Street, but fine in El Paso. On the other hand, in Cincinnati, you met John Euclid, a wholesale jeweler who's lost business, and he says he has customers, for instance, on army bases. He used to sell jewelry to them. They sold it to troops, but the troops are all overseas. But it's such a mixed bag, it seems, David Whitford. So give us your overarching thoughts about what you came away from this trip with.
Well, first of all, I want to say that the locations that I chose were somewhat arbitrary. I did not visit New Orleans. I did not visit Detroit. I did not visit many of the areas of the country that are suffering the harshest effects of this tough economy. That said, I did go to a range of places where the economy is doing reasonably well and where it's doing reasonably poorly. And I think overall what I found is that business owners, small business owners, are not so much concerned with what's happening in the larger world. They're affected by rising gas prices. You know, for example, I talked to a motorcycle shop owner in Medford, Oregon, who says that his ATV rental business is down because gas prices are up. On the other hand, his motorcycle sales are up because when people can't afford to drive their car anymore, they'd rather buy a motorcycle. I think the basic thing I learned is that entrepreneurs are by nature optimistic people. If they're going to survive, they're flexible and they're creative and they're inventive and they're concerned with what's right in front of their faces. And the entrepreneurs that I met overall are doing a good job of adjusting to vagaries in the economy and figuring out a way to succeed under adverse conditions.
David Whitford, editor-at-large for Fortune Magazine, his article Recession Road Trip appears in the current edition. For more, you can go to our website here-now.org. David, thanks for visiting us.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, how are you doing? If you're a small business owner, we'd love to hear from you. In fact, we'd love anyone's thoughts on the program. Our email address is letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call and leave a message, 617-358-0397. Still ahead, Adventure Racing. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, if you watched Super Tuesday coverage, you also saw pictures of incredible weather sweeping through the South. An estimated 80 tornadoes touched down in several states yesterday, from Tennessee to Kentucky and Arkansas. At least 48 people were killed, and it isn't over yet. More severe thunderstorms are expected today. Tennessee has been the worst hit so far, and for more on the story, we start with Julie Oakes. She's with the Tennessee Emergency Management Agency. Julie, give us an overview of how the storms have affected Tennessee.
We have 24 confirmed dead at this point, over 149 injured. We have at least one person that's still missing. The bulk of that is coming from Macon County, which is in Middle Tennessee, about a few counties northwest of Nashville. We have 10 confirmed fatalities there, 65 injuries at least. At this point, we have a lot of widespread damage. We have a number of people that are without power at this time. At least 54,000 people are without power. We have debris in a number of counties in West and Middle Tennessee. We have crews fanned out all over the place trying to work to clean up that debris, rescue any people that may still be trapped in their homes, and just get a clear assessment of the situation.
Well, tell us about, speaking of which, the university students who were trapped at Union University, 16 temporarily trapped. Are they all right?
They are all okay. We had three that did have critical injuries, but the good news is that everyone is alive and we were able to get them out.
Well, we're hearing that in part that's because people in your area are used to this. They've done the tornado drills. I mean, was that a factor?
I think it definitely was a factor. In Tennessee, especially in western Tennessee and Jackson area, we've seen a number of tornadoes in that area in the past several years. And I think it is something that, unfortunately, we are accustomed to. But the good news is that people are aware of what's going on. They know when they need to take cover and find a safe location, and they do that.
But just, I mean, it sounds like such a wild ride. We were reading about the Hickory Ridge Mall that's in Memphis, just completely torn apart. People who were trying to take shelter under a bridge were washed away. They were then found, but just a lot of wild stories.
It definitely is, and we have seen so much damage in the state. It's just really incomprehensible. I talked to one person last night out on Interstate 40 who said there were, you know, literally 25 tractor and trailers that looked like they had been picked up and twisted and just tossed aside like they were a toy. Mm. So it really just it is very devastating.
Well, and this all makes, you know, Super Tuesday seem sort of insignificant, you know, but did people get to finish their voting?
As far as I know, I actually got to go vote yesterday here in Nashville, and I know the storms did start to roll through in Memphis around 6 o'clock, so I'm not sure on that part in Memphis, but I know polls did close at 7, so I think most people did have the ability to get out and vote.
Julie Oakes with the Tennessee Emergency Management Agency, thanks so much.
Thanks, Robin.
Well, for a while, university students were trapped at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee. We turn now to Andrew McMurtry, who's a photographer with the Jackson Sun. Andrew, what did you see at Union?
Devastation, something I've never really seen before. Tornado came through the northern part of the city and tore through the dormitories at Union University. Students were trapped under, you know, 5-6 feet of rubble. This complete dorms demolished.
What, by the way, did you see the tornado itself?
No. When the sirens went off, I was in the newsroom, and they forced everybody down to the basement for our own well-being.
Well, the president of Union says the fact that the kids had done a lot of tornado drills saved lives, but how long were they trapped, and how were they communicating? We understand some were talking by cell phone.
From what I heard when I arrived on the scene through rescue officials and the president himself, said they were talking to the rescuers, you know, while they were underneath all the rubble. As for cell phones, I don't know.
Andrew, the photographs are always mind-boggling. Tell us some of the things that you saw. Rubble is one thing, but we're hearing about tractor trailers that look like, you know, toy trucks. What did you see through your lens?
Well, I'm actually standing on the side of the road now. I'm on assignment. Power lines are down. I'm standing next to a nursing home. The roof is torn off, and construction crews are working to clean up. Local businesses are destroyed. The roofs are blown off. Windows are broken. It's just hard getting around. There's no power in some parts of the town still, and slow moving.
Andrew McMurtry is a photographer with the Jackson Sun. He's been talking to us from Jackson, Tennessee, one of the hardest hit states in last night's series of tornadoes. Andrew, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And, of course, we'll keep an eye on the storms in the south for you. But when we come back, people who put themselves in harm's way for the sport of it, that's in 1 minute, here and now. Jennifer Schultes is a mild-mannered faculty assistant at Harvard University's Kennedy School. But come the weekend, she dons her technical performance gear as captain of the national champion Eastern Mountain Sports Adventure Racing Team. Now, superstars may focus on the Olympics, but Jennifer is part of a community of international athletes participating in races that take days and cross hundreds of miles of jungle and river. They swim through alligator-infested swamps and rappel over mountain gorges, carrying not just their backpacks, but their mountain bikes. Her next race with the EMS team is the Swamp Stomp. It's a 30-hour paddling, trekking, and climbing adventure through remote ecosystems in Southwest Florida. It takes place later this month, and Jennifer joins us in the studio to tell us about it. Welcome.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Are you out of your mind? Tell me some of the things that you've come across in doing this sort of adventure racing, some of the obstacles.
Well, you mentioned the alligators a moment ago, and that's always the thing that really sort of put me outside of my comfort zone. But it's funny how when the gun goes off and you're in a race situation and you've been told, listen, it's fine, swim through the river, the alligators don't want any part of you, and you just go, and you do that.
Alligators in the water. And what's it like, for instance, rappelling down a mountain with your mountain bike?
Well,
where do you put it?
You hang it on a sling. I haven't actually rappelled off of a mountain, but I've done zip lining between cliffs, like over gorges, with my mountain bike. And when you start pulling yourself over, the bike starts swinging and it starts whacking you, and it's actually more uncomfortable than it is adventurous.
Well, let's talk about how it works, because we understand there's a sort of a loose governing board. It's the U.S. Adventure Racing Association, and they've gone from 11 races in 98 to 300-plus races in 2006 with over 20,000 racers entering events in 2006. So this has become a huge sport. How does it work? How do you get on the team? Do you qualify?
Teams are formed a variety of different ways. To be on my team, because we are a sponsored team, there is a process that involves sort of a tryout period where we need to establish that probably you can hold up to racing fast and for a long period of time, but also that you're the right kind of person for the team. Having the right fit for the team, the right personality, because there is so much strategy involved in this sport and teamwork, because we do all race together on the course at the same time.
Well, tell us about that. How does a race work normally?
Okay. Teams are comprised of anywhere between 2 and 4 people generally, and we all have to be within 30 yards of each other throughout the entire race. Teams are also co-ed, so there needs to be at least one man and one woman on the team. And because there are going to be differences in speed, the team has to work together to figure out how to maximize their overall speed. And so you see a lot of towing systems in these races. We actually hook up bungee cords to each other on bikes and while we're running through the woods, whatever we can to sort of average out the speed for the team.
And I understand that you can't have any GPS devices or modern technology like that. And sometimes the map itself of the course is a secret until you get there.
That's right, and they usually are. Oftentimes, for example, we're doing a race in June this year in New England, and all the race directors are telling us at this time is this is the closest airport.
And that's it?
And that's it.
We understand that sometimes, you know, finding the map is a part of the race.
There have been races where they only give us part of the map in the beginning, and we have to race through part of the course, and then we're given the next part of the map. We don't have a chance to study the map at all. We have to literally, on the fly, figure out what our best course is going to be, because that's the thing about adventure racing is it's not like a road race where they tell you turn left here, turn right here. You literally have to go from point A to point B, and you can go any way you want.
But this isn't a treasure hunt. This is real athletic skill from what I understand. I mean, how much athletic skill is it?
You know, it's hard to put it in percentage points, but if I had to estimate, I would say probably 70% athletic And 30% is strategy, and that's one of the reasons my team does so well. It's not because we're so fast. We are a fast team, but if you were to take all of the racers that show up at a race and just have a flat-out foot and bicycle race, we wouldn't win that race. But the way that we win is through strategy. It's figuring out which routes we're going to take, when we're going to sleep, what gear we're going to take with us.
So, I mean, can you give us a sense, let's say in the Stomp that's coming up, what will be in that race? How many miles of biking, climbing, swimming?
I would anticipate that the race will be a little over 100 miles long, which on one hand it sounds long, but anyone who does...
Yes, it does.
But anyone who's done an Ironman triathlon knows that that is a distance that's easily covered in just a handful of hours. But we're not on road bikes, and we're not running on flat roads. We're running through brush and up and over hills, and we're looking at maps. So, you know, I would say a race like Swamp Stomp, we can expect probably 30 miles of it to be paddling, maybe 55 of it on bike, maybe another 30 on foot.
We first became really aware of you after our colleague Karen Miller-Medson ran with you and then turned and saw you had a car with all these logos on it, you know, the EMS logos. But other than that, you're fairly anonymous. How do you feel about that? Is it enough for you to have the wins and to have the accomplishment of having completed these long races, or do you wish that maybe there was more recognition for the sport?
On one hand, it's nice that the sport hasn't seen a lot of money pumped into it and a lot of glitz and glam, because the race really is about getting out and being in the outdoors and, you know, finding hidden routes and secrets out there in the woods. But you get torn. You know, part of you wishes that there was a little bit more attention to the sport because it is such a great sport.
You're captain of the EMS team. I see the picture. There's you, another woman, and like five big guys. in the competition, does the testosterone ever get in the way of, you know, does there ever become a conflict?
Definitely. And the guys will not be, they will not give me a hard time about answering this question. No, it's true. I mean, these are big, strong, testosterone-driven guys. And what's really interesting is that we have this great relationship. For me, actually, that is part of the biggest challenge for me with this team is running it, because I am not a natural-born leader in my own mind. I hate conflict, and so I've had to learn how to use soft power with these guys.
Well, some people worry about the impact of adventure racing, I know you know this, on ecosystems, because here you are traipsing through swamplands and the Swamp Stomp. And we understand you're conscious of that. What are some of the things you do? For instance, in one race, you had to bring out your garbage or something?
Anybody who has ever raced with me knows that I am somebody who will always stop and pick up garbage, and they're always yelling at me, come on, let's go. But you know, it's important to me, especially when you see trash and you know it's from other racers, because it's obviously race food. I'm always picking up that stuff. So people joke, they say, if you want to slow down Team Eastern Mountain Sports, just leave your trash around, you know, because Jen will be picking it up the whole time. And there's some truth to that. But one race, you're right. One of the special challenges in the race was that we had to go on a section of trail where there was a lot of garbage, and we had to drag out garbage with us, and we got bonus points for bringing, you know, both the most unique trash and the most trash out.
Now, you're sponsored by EMS, which means what? They don't pay you a salary. What, they pay you to get to races and give you the kayaks and things?
That's right. They pay for our race expenses. We don't stay at the Ritz-Carlton, but it's nice to have that extra support. It helps me to get good teammates. And the sport is expensive. I mean, there's no doubt about it, not just the actual races themselves, but the training that's involved in it. So they help pay for our airfare to get to these places, hotels, our race entry fees.
That's Jennifer Schultes, a faculty assistant at Harvard University's Kennedy School, also captain of the national champion Eastern Mountain Sports Adventure Racing Team. Jennifer, thanks for speaking with us.
It's been wonderful. Thank you.